Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open with some top local stories, including the latest on schools set to reopen as early as September 1st in San Diego County. La Mesa is looking for a new police chief, and we'll have details on that search. East County State Senator Republican Brian Jones has tested positive for COVID-19, forcing Republicans exposed to the virus to cast their votes from home during the final days of the state legislative session, with crucial bills pending. Next up, we'll have a report on the Republican and Democratic National Convention acceptance speeches by President Donald Trump and Joe Biden, including how they measured up to fact-checking and who told the most whoppers. Then, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including coverage of Hurricane Laura, the rise in depression related to quarantining, racial segregation issues in housing, and more. And finally, we have a warning from health officials on oleandrin, an extract of the deadly oleander plant being touted as a possible cure for COVID-19, despite a lack of any human testing, and even a tiny amount can be fatal. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Jonathan Getz with an education report. All local schools can reopen for in-person instruction starting on September 1st, San Diego County public health officials have announced. The decision does not require schools to reopen, however. Each district will determine whether it wishes to resume in-classroom instruction, continue with online learning, or a combination of both. The action, announced in a telebriefing with school administrators, comes after the county was removed from the state's monitoring list last Tuesday, setting in motion a 14-day time frame after which the state will allow in-class education to reopen. The state requires that cases stay at 100 or fewer per 100,000 population. San Diego has stayed below that level for over a week and must remain below that level until at least Tuesday, September 1st. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says schools can remain open even if the county is placed back on the state's COVID-19 monitoring list. Though, she cautions, if case rates become astronomically high again, that's a game changer. The reopening order applies to all schools, K-12, as well as colleges and universities, including public, private, and charter facilities. On August 22nd, the county approved waivers for 27 schools, mostly private religious institutions, to reopen for in-person learning. Around 50 schools had applied. However, Dr. Wooten said the county has now suspended the waiver program. Quote, "It didn't make sense to continue to process applications," said Wooten, "since all schools will be able to reopen Tuesday. To reopen for in-person learning, schools must have a plan approved for safe reopening that complies with state guidelines. However, many have already submitted these, as planning has been in the works for weeks. Businesses that are closed cannot yet reopen, however, until the state releases updated guidelines now in the works.
The city of La Mesa plans to hire an executive recruiting firm to conduct a national search for a new chief of police, according to a news release issued by the city. There will be a community input component to this selection process, which is expected to take several months. Meanwhile, Captain Matt Nicholas is serving as acting chief of police effective August 28th. Chief Vasquez began his law enforcement career in 1986 with San Diego Police Department, rising to the rank of assistant chief before being sworn in as La Mesa's chief of police in April 2015. He announced his retirement during a town hall meeting on police issues, which came as a surprise to some council members who were not previously informed. Chief Vasquez said his team has worked hard to keep citizens of La Mesa safe over the last 5 years, noting that the decrease in property and violent crime in the city from 2015 to 2019 during his term has been the largest decrease of all incorporated cities in our county. But the department has faced controversy in recent months over several incidents, including handling of a racial justice protest at the La Mesa police station May 30th that erupted into violence. After some protesters threw rocks and bottles at police, police declared an unlawful assembly and fired tear gas, pepper spray, and beanbag projectiles at protesters, seriously injuring a woman struck in the head. Looting, rioting, and burning down of three buildings occurred later that night. Days before the protest, which was part of national demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer, a controversial stop of Amare Johnson, a young black man at a trolley station by a white La Mesa police officer, was partly caught on video that went viral amid accusations of racial profiling. The officer claimed Johnson assaulted him, but the charge was dropped after body cam footage failed to back up the officer's version of the incident. That officer has since left the force. 2 years earlier, a white La Mesa police school resource officer was shown on video knocking a handcuffed black teenage girl to the ground at Helix Charter High School. The city later settled a lawsuit filed by the teen, though an investigation found the officer did not violate police procedures. He was also moved out of serving in schools but remained on the force. In an interview with our media outlet days after the protest and riot May 30th, Chief Vasquez said, "Reaching out to help heal the community is needed," and he pledged that that would happen, in his words, "without a doubt." At subsequent protests, Chief Vasquez did meet with protest organizers and was seen embracing black members of the Buffalo Soldiers Motorcycle Club. La Mesa police ended its use of a controversial chokehold and arrested a counter-protester for battery of a protester. Though some residents contend that police turned a blind eye to actions of some people who claimed they came to defend La Mesa from protesters, but engaged in threats and intimidation, brandishing weapons including knives, pepper spray, and tasers. The departure of Chief Vasquez presents an opportunity for the city to select a new chief who can expand efforts to heal the racial divide while also assuring protection for all La Mesa residents and businesses. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. This is Miriam Raftery.
State Senator Brian Jones, a Republican from Santee who represents most of San Diego's East County, has tested positive for COVID-19. The finding prompted a temporary adjournment of the State Senate just days before the August 31st end of the legislative session, putting the fate of some pending bills in question. The announcement, made on Senator Jones' social media, states that he received the test result after returning to Sacramento for the end of the legislative session. The statement indicates he will be taking additional tests to rule out the possibility of a false positive result. In the meantime, he'll be following protocols of the Centers for Disease Control and California Department of Health, which include isolating at home. The statement does not indicate when the senator was tested or whether he has had any symptoms. Jones has been wearing a mask when speaking on the Senate floor as recently as Monday. State Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins canceled Wednesday's floor session after confirming that a, quote, member of the Senate family tested positive. She says, "The Senate will be prepared to continue our work when we have completed public health protocols to ensure that the risk of exposure has been eliminated. Masks and social distancing are required in the Capitol. Deep cleaning and contact tracing are being done to assure that anyone exposed will be notified," Atkins has indicated. The State Senate has been allowing members to vote from their district offices on committee matters, but has required in-person voting for the full Senate, where legislators often meet to negotiate with fellow legislators, stakeholders, and lobbyists. Tony Atkins has announced that Republicans exposed to COVID can vote from home on Senate floor measures. The disruption will make it more challenging for the legislature to complete consideration of bills pending before the August 31st deadline, including measures that would offer long-term foreclosure and eviction protections to homeowners, renters, and landlords impacted by the pandemic. A major police reform bill is also awaiting action. Senator Jones chairs the Senate Republican Caucus in Sacramento. He previously served on the Santee City Council and in the State Assembly. He ran for Congress in the 50th Congressional District, the seat vacated by Duncan Hunter, but lost the primary race to Daryl Issa. Jones has been a critic of Governor Gavin Newsom's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. He has accused Democrats of exaggerating the crisis. The conservative senator has opposed closing houses of worship and beaches, also calling for a more rapid reopening of businesses. The senator recently hosted a blood drive to increase blood bank donations, which were running low due to COVID-19. On Facebook, he posted, Luckily, we were able to fill every time slot for a blood donation, which will save lives. Now on the Senator's Facebook page, many of his constituents have posted prayers and wishes for him to remain healthy. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is the East County Magazine Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Miriam Raftery with a Tribal Beat report. A federal judge has handed the Trump administration a win Thursday by refusing to halt construction of a section of border wall near Campo. Judge Anthony Battaglia heard arguments via teleconference for and against a temporary restraining order sought by the La Posta Band of Degaño Mission Indians. He rejected a bid for a preliminary injunction as well, canceling a scheduled September 17th motion hearing. Among the targets of the civil suit are President Trump, Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, and Defense Secretary Mark Esper. The issue boiled down to is the project zone a drug smuggling area that requires an immediate wall or a sacred burial site that federal law protects? Simon Gertler, attorney for the tribe, said if remains are pulverized, there's no way to bring them back, and he added that money meant for the wall could be better spent on other means of drug interdiction. But the judge, nominated to his post by President Obama, agreed with the government, for now. He noted that the Supreme Court has supported the Pentagon shifting military money to build the border wall and has halted a preliminary injunction by lower courts that blocked wall construction for other reasons. According to the judge, the tribe failed to meet the burden of proof that it likely would prevail at a trial, hence the denial of the preliminary injunction and temporary restraining order. As to which side faced the most harm, Battaglia accepted government assertions about a huge influx of drugs, noting the many drug cases on his own judicial calendar. The tribe sought to halt construction on two of the 31 border wall segments approved to build in parts of San Diego and Imperial counties. The government lawyers argued the Border Patrol has had over 480 separate drug-related events in fiscal year 2019 on the San Diego and Imperial County borders where the wall would be built. But the La Posta Band, represented by Sacramento attorneys Michelle LaPena and Gertler, said the government has other ways of halting drug smuggling. They added, defendants are wrong to challenge La Posta's traditional knowledge that the project is excavating Kumeyaay burial grounds and split hairs to suggest these burial grounds are not historic cemeteries to avoid scrutiny. The suit asked that construction be halted only until measures are taken to mitigate potential impacts to cultural resources, such as establishing a formal tribal monitoring program with at least two tribal monitors at each construction site, and allowing monitors to be close enough to watch construction and witness any uncovering of cultural materials. The La Posta Band alleges it has not been properly consulted by the government about the project or the investigation of human remains, and that only one cultural monitor from the tribe has been allowed within the entire 21-mile project area. The tribe alleges that construction has already uncovered some historic tribal burials and threatens a tribal historic cemetery in Hakumba Hot Springs. Some tribal members have taken to protesting the wall's construction, even physically blocking the paths of construction vehicles and standing in areas slated for pre-construction blasting with dynamite.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
At the Republican National Convention, President Donald Trump opened his acceptance speech by thanking supporters and then accusing Democrats of supporting violence in American cities resulting from protests. He sought to position Republicans as the party of law and order. Here's some of what he said.
Together, we will lead our party back to the White House, and we will lead our country back to safety, prosperity, and peace. We will be a country of generosity and warmth, but we will also be a country of law and order. Our convention occurs at a moment of crisis for our nation. The attacks on our police and the terrorism of our cities threaten our very way of life. Any politician who does not grasp this danger is not fit to lead our country.
But though Trump denounced violence by protesters and rioters, he made no mention of violence by police that ignited those protests, such as the most recent in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where a white officer shot an unarmed black man 7 times in front of his children, leaving the man paralyzed. At a protest over the Kenosha shooting, an armed counter-protester shot and killed 2 protesters. On Thursday, Joe Biden's vice presidential running mate, Kamala Harris, issued a video statement condemning acts of violence on all sides. Here's what she had to say.
Jacob Blake shot 7 times in the back in broad daylight in front of his 3 young sons. 7 times in the back in broad daylight in front of his 3 young sons. As Vice President Biden put it, the shots fired at Mr. Blake pierced the soul of our nation. It's sickening to watch. It's all too familiar. And it must end. Thankfully, he is alive today. But he is fighting for his life, and he shouldn't have to be. My heart goes out to the Blake family as they endure an ordeal that is tragically common in our country. Joe and I spoke with them yesterday. They are an amazing group of people with extraordinary courage. Even in their pain and their grief, even as they seek justice for their son, they spoke about the need to end the violence and heal our nation. I've had conversations like this with far too many mothers and fathers, but you will see and hear no one with more courage, more character, and more moral clarity. People are rightfully angry and exhausted. And after the murders of Breonna and George and Ahmaud and so many others, it's no wonder people are taken to the streets. And I support them. We must always defend peaceful protest and peaceful protesters. We should not confuse them with those looting and committing acts of violence, including the shooter who was arrested for murder. And make no mistake, we will not let these vigilantes and extremists derail the path to justice. Here is my promise to those mothers and fathers and all who stand with them. In a Biden-Harris administration, you will have a seat at the table, in the halls of Congress, and in the White House.
Trump has said Biden supports defunding police and suggested that under a Biden presidency, violent protests would not be curtailed. Biden has called for linking federal law enforcement funding to policing reforms to reduce racial disparities, but Biden has actually indicated he supports an increase in community policing and also supports shifting some funds from military gear for police into investments in social services. Trump sought to stoke fear by claiming Democrats will demolish the suburbs, referring to a Biden plan to reinstate an Obama housing rule. Experts have indicated that restoring that regulation would not force any zoning changes or building any low-income housing in neighborhoods, but would simply prohibit housing discrimination based on race. Trump further distorted his own record on racial issues. He claimed he's done more for the African-American community than any president since Abraham Lincoln, who freed the slaves. Now, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, the 2 most significant pieces of legislation to help African Americans, and many other presidents have done considerable things to put forward desegregation. The Voting Rights Act was recently gutted by the Supreme Court, and in fact, Trump has opposed congressional efforts to restore those cherished voting protections. A Quinnipiac University poll of black citizens found that they voiced a 93% disapproval of Trump, with only 4% supporting his candidacy. Trump also distorted his record on the economy. He stated, "Over the last 3 months, we have gained over 9 million jobs, a new record." That statement ignores the fact that the nation lost 22 million jobs due to COVID-19 shutdowns. The 9 million jobs gained were due to partly reopening closed-down businesses. Only about 40% of those jobs have been restored as of July, the last month for which figures are available. The U.S. unemployment rate hit 14.7% in April, the worst since 1948, and unemployment remains above 10% today. The president also provided false statements on COVID-19. He claimed the U.S. has among the lowest case fatality rate of any major country from COVID-19. This is just false. According to Johns Hopkins University, the nation's top medical school, the U.S. actually has one of the worst death rates, at 54.9 deaths per every 100,000 people. That's worse than all but 10 nations on Earth. As for total cases, the U.S. has by far the most cases of COVID-19 of any country in the world. Trump also claimed we developed from scratch the largest and most advanced testing system in the world for coronavirus. But in fact, the U.S. was slower than other nations to roll out tests. That's partly because the U.S. refused to allow tests approved by the World Health Organization that were used successfully in other countries. After developing its own tests, the U.S. has still tested a lower percentage of the population than most other nations. This week, the Centers for Disease Control under Trump drew criticism from medical experts after calling for tests to be discontinued on patients without symptoms, even if they're known to be exposed, and exposed patients can spread the disease for days before showing symptoms. President Trump exaggerated some other claims, too. He claimed the border wall is completed, but in fact, only 5 new miles of the wall have been actually built, with a couple of 100 more miles of existing fencing that has been fortified, including here in San Diego. The vast majority of the 2,000-mile border still has no physical barrier. The president distorted Joe Biden's tax plan, claiming Biden pledged a $4 trillion tax hike on almost all American families. Now, Biden specifically pledged not to raise taxes on anybody earning less than $400,000 a year, and the Tax Policy Center estimated that over 90% of his tax increase would be on the wealthiest 20% of Americans. On foreign policy, Trump claimed we obliterated 100% of the ISIS caliphate. While it is true that by the end of his first year in office, 98% of ISIS-controlled territory in Iraq had been recaptured by coalition forces. About 2/3 of that actually happened under the Obama administration. Trump further accused Biden of voting for the Iraq War in 2003. While that is true, Trump failed to mention that he also supported that 2003 invasion of Iraq in a 2002 interview with Howard Stern, and that Vice President Mike Pence voted for the Iraq War while he was in Congress. Now, for those wondering about the accuracy of former Vice President Joe Biden's acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention, which promised fact over fiction, fact-checkers from several major news organizations found his claims to be mostly true. However, the Poynter Institute did find that Biden actually underestimated the number of Americans infected with COVID-19 during Donald Trump's presidency, perhaps relying on outdated numbers, and may also have underestimated the number of people projected to lose health insurance due to losing their jobs in the pandemic. Next up, we'll be airing Joe Biden's acceptance speech, which at 24 minutes we can run in its entirety here on our radio show, unlike Donald Trump's, which ran more than an hour and a half.
Ella Baker, a giant of the civil rights movement, left us with this wisdom: give people light, and they will find the way. Give people light. Those are words for our time. The current president has cloaked American darkness for much too long. Too much anger, too much fear, too much division. Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America. We'll choose hope over fear, facts over fiction, fairness over privilege. I'm a proud Democrat, and I'll be proud to carry the banner of our party into the general election. So it's with great honor and humility I accept this nomination for president of the United States of America. But while I'll be a Democratic candidate, I will be an American president. I'll work hard for those who didn't support me, as hard for them as I did for those who did vote for me. That's the job of a president, to represent all of us, not just our base or our party. This is not a partisan moment. This must be an American moment. It's a moment that calls for hope and light and love, hope for our future, light to see our way forward, and love for one another. America isn't just a collection of clashing interests of red states or blue states. We're so much bigger than that. We're so much better than that. You know, nearly a century ago, Franklin Roosevelt pledged a New Deal in a time of massive unemployment, uncertainty, and fear. Stricken by a disease, stricken by a virus, FDR insisted that he would recover and prevail, and he believed America could as well. And he did, and we can as well. This campaign isn't just about winning votes. It's about winning the heart and, yes, the soul of America. Winning it for the generous among us, not the selfish. Winning it for workers who keep this country going, not just the privileged few at the top. Winning it for those communities who have known the injustice of a knee on the neck. For all the young people who have known only America being rising inequity and shrinking opportunity, they deserve the experience of America's promise. They deserve to experience it in full. You know, no generation ever knows what history will ask of it. All we can ever know is whether we're ready when that moment arrives. And now history has delivered us to one of the most difficult moments America's ever faced. Four historic crises, all at the same time. A perfect storm, the worst pandemic in over 100 years, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the most compelling call for racial justice since the 60s, and the undeniable realities and just the accelerating threats of climate change. So the question for us is simple. Are we ready? I believe we are. We must be. You know, all elections are important. We know in our bones this one is more consequential. As many have said, America is at an inflection point, a time of real peril, but also of extraordinary possibilities. We can choose a path of becoming angrier, less hopeful, more divided, a path of shadow and suspicion, or we can choose a different path and together take this chance to heal, to reform, to unite. A path of hope and light. This is a life-changing election. This will determine what America is going to look like for a long, long time. Character is on the ballot. Compassion is on the ballot. Decency, science, democracy, they're all on the ballot. Who we are as a nation, what we stand for, and most importantly, who we want to be, that's all on the ballot. And the choice could not be more clear. No rhetoric is needed. Just judge this president on the facts. 5 million Americans infected by COVID-19. More than 170,000 Americans have died. By far the worst performance of any nation on earth. More than 50 million people have filed for unemployment this year. More than 10 million people are going to lose their health insurance this year. Nearly 1 in 6 small businesses have closed this year. And this president, if he's reelected, you know what will happen. Cases and deaths will remain far too high. More mom-and-pop businesses will close their doors, and this time for good. Working families will struggle to get by. And yet the wealthiest 1% will get tens of billions of dollars in new tax breaks. And the assault on the Affordable Care Act will continue until it's destroyed, taking insurance away from more than 20 million people, including more than 15 million people on Medicaid, and getting rid of the protections that President Obama worked so hard to get passed for people who have 100 million more people who have pre-existing conditions. And speaking of President Obama, a man I was honored to serve alongside for 8 years as vice president. Let me take this moment to say something we don't say nearly enough. Thank you, Mr. President. You were a great president, a president our children could and did look up to. No one's going to say that about the current occupant of the White House. What we know about this president is if he's given four more years, he'll be what he's been for the last 4 years. A president who takes no responsibility, refuses to lead, blames others, cozies up to dictators, and fans the flames of hate and division. He'll wake up every day believing the job is all about him, never about you. Is that the American you want for you, your family, your children? I see a different America, one that's generous and strong, selfless and humble. It's an America we can rebuild together. As president, the first step I will take will be to get control of the virus that has ruined so many lives. Because I understand something this president hasn't from the beginning. We will never get our economy back on track. We will never get our kids safely back in schools. We'll never have our lives back until we deal with this virus. The tragedy of where we are today is it didn't have to be this bad. Just look around. It's not this bad in Canada or Europe or Japan or almost anywhere else in the world. And the president keeps telling us the virus is going to disappear. He keeps waiting for a miracle. Well, I have news for him. No miracle is coming. We lead the world in confirmed cases. We lead the world in deaths. Our economy is in tatters with Black, Latino, Asian American, Native American communities bearing the brunt of it. And after all this time, the president still does not have a plan. Well, I do. If I'm your president, on day one, we'll implement the national strategy I've been laying out since March. We'll develop and deploy rapid tests with results available immediately. We'll make the medical supplies and protective equipment that our country needs. And we'll make them here in America so we will never again be at the mercy of China or other foreign countries in order to protect our own people. We'll make sure our schools have the resources they need to be open, safe, and effective. We'll put politics aside. We'll take the muzzle off our experts so the public gets the information they need and deserve. Honest, unvarnished truth. They can handle it. We'll have a national mandate to wear masks, not as a burden, but as a patriotic duty to protect one another. In short, we'll do what we should have done from the very beginning. Our current president has failed in his most basic duty to the nation. He's failed to protect us. He's failed to protect America. And my fellow Americans, that is unforgivable. As president, I'll make you a promise. I'll protect America. I will defend us from every attack, seen and unseen, always, without exception, every time. Look, I understand. I understand how hard it is to have any hope right now. On this summer night, let me take a moment to speak to those of you who have lost the most. I have some idea how it feels to lose someone you love. I know that deep black hole that opens up in the middle of your chest and you feel like you're being sucked into it. I know how mean and cruel and unfair life can be sometimes. But I've learned two things. First, your loved one may have left this earth, but they'll never leave your heart. They'll always be with you. You'll always hear them. And second, I found the best way through pain and loss and grief is to find purpose. As God's children, each of us have a purpose in our lives. We have a great purpose as a nation to open the doors of opportunity to all Americans, to save our democracy, to be a light to the world once again, and finally to live up to and make real the words written in the sacred documents that founded this nation. That all men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, my dad was an honorable, decent man. He got knocked down a few times, pretty hard, but he always got back up. He worked hard, and he built a great middle-class life for our family. He used to say, Joey, I don't expect the government to solve my problems, but I sure in hell expect them to understand them. And then he'd say, Joey, a job is about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about your place in the community. It's about being able to look your kid in the eye and say, honey, it's going to be okay, and mean it. I've never forgotten those lessons. That's why my economic plan is all about jobs, dignity, respect, and community. Together we can and will rebuild our economy. And when we do, we'll not only build back, we'll build back better. With modern roads, bridges, highways, broadband, ports and airports, as a new foundation for economic growth, with pipes that transport clean water to every community, with 5 million new manufacturing and technology jobs, so the future is made in America. With a healthcare system that lowers premiums, deductibles, drug prices, by building on the Affordable Care Act he's trying to rip away. With an education system that trains our people for the best jobs of the 21st century. There's not a single thing American workers can't do. And where cost doesn't prevent young people from going to college and student debt doesn't crush them when they get out. With a child care and elder care system that makes it possible for parents to go to work and for the elderly to stay in their homes with dignity. With an immigration system that powers our economy and reflects our values. And with newly empowered labor unions. They're the ones that built the middle class. With equal pay for women, with rising wages, you can raise a child on, a family on. And yes, we're going to do more than praise our essential workers. We're finally going to pay them, pay them. We can and we will deal with climate change. It's not only a crisis, it's an enormous opportunity. An opportunity for America to lead the world in clean energy and create millions of new good-paying jobs in the process. And we can pay for these investments by ending loopholes, unnecessary loopholes, and the president's $1.3 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest 1% and the biggest, most profitable corporations, some of which do not pay any tax at all. Because we don't need a tax code that rewards wealth more than it rewards work. I'm not looking to punish anyone. Far from it. But it's long past time the wealthiest people and the biggest corporations in this country paid their fair share. And for our seniors, Social Security is a sacred obligation, a sacred promise made, they paid for. The current president is threatening to break that promise. He's proposing to eliminate a tax that pays for almost half the Social Security without any way of making up for that lost revenue, resulting in cuts. I will not let that happen. If I'm your president, we're going to protect Social Security and Medicare. You have my word. One of the most powerful voices we hear in the country today is from our young people. They're speaking to the inequity and injustice that has grown up in America. Economic injustice, racial injustice, environmental injustice. I hear their voices. If you listen, you can hear them too. And whether it's the existential threat posed by climate change, the daily fear of being gunned down in school, or the inability to get started in your first job, it will be the work of the next president to restore the promise of America to everyone. And I'm not going to have to do it alone, because I'll have a great vice president at my side, Senator Kamala Harris. She's a powerful voice for this nation. Her story is the American story. She knows about all the obstacles thrown in the way of so many in our country. Women, Black Americans, South Asian Americans, immigrants, the left out and the left behind. But she's overcome every obstacle she's ever faced. No one's been tougher on the big banks and the gun lobby. No one's been tougher in calling out the current administration for its extremism, its failure to follow the law, its failure to simply tell the truth. Kamala and I both draw from our families. That's where we get our strength. For Kamala, it's Doug and their families. For me, it's Jill and ours. I've said many times, no man deserves one great love in his life, let alone two. But I've known two. After losing my first wife in that car accident, Jill came into my life. She put our family back together. She's an educator, a mom, a military mom, and an unstoppable force. If she puts her mind to it, just get out of the way. She's going to get it done. She was a great second lady. And I know she'll make a great first lady for this nation. She loves this country so much. And I'll always have the strength that can only come from family. Hunter, Ashley, all our grandchildren, my brothers, my sister, they give me courage. They lift me up. While he's no longer with us, Bo inspires me every day. Bo served our nation in uniform. A year in Iraq, a decorated Iraqi war veteran. So I take very personally and the profound responsibility of serving as commander in chief. I'll be a president who will stand with our allies and friends and make it clear to our adversaries the days of cozying up to dictators is over. Under President Biden, America will not turn a blind eye to Russian bounties on the heads of American soldiers. Nor will I put up with foreign interference in our most sacred democratic exercise, voting. And I'll always stand for our values of human rights and dignity. I'll work in common purpose for a more secure, peaceful, and prosperous world. History has thrust one more urgent task on us. Will we be the generation that finally wipes out the stain of racism from our national character? I believe we're up to it. I believe we're ready. Just a week ago yesterday was the third anniversary of the events in Charlottesville. Close your eyes. Remember what you saw on television. Remember seeing those neo-Nazis and Klansmen and white supremacists coming out of fields with lighted torches, veins bulging, spewing the same anti-Semitic bile heard across Europe in the 30s. Remember the violent clash that ensued between those spreading hate and those with the courage to stand against it. And remember what the president said when asked? He said there were, quote, very fine people on both sides. It was a wake-up call for us as a country, and for me, a call to action. At that moment, I knew I'd have to run, because my father taught us that silence was complicity, and I could never remain silent or complicit. At the time, I said we're in the battle for the soul of this nation. And we are. You know, one of the most important conversations I've had this entire campaign, it was with someone who was much too young to vote. I met with 6-year-old Gianna Floyd the day before her daddy, George Floyd, was laid to rest. She's an incredibly brave little girl. And I'll never forget it. When I leaned down to speak to her, she looked in my eyes and she said, and I quote, "Daddy changed the world. Daddy changed the world." Her words burrowed deep into my heart. Maybe George Floyd's murder was a breaking point. Maybe John Lewis is passing the inspiration. But however it's come to be, however it's happened, America's ready, in John's words, to lay down, quote, the heavy burden of hate at last. And to end the hard work of rooting out our systemic racism. You know, American history tells us that it's been in our darkest moments that we've made our greatest progress, that we found the light. And this dark moment, I believe we're poised to make great progress again, that we can find the light once more. You know, many people have heard me say this, but I've always believed you can define America in one word: possibilities. The defining feature of America, everything is possible. That in America, everyone, and I mean everyone, should be given an opportunity to go as far as their dreams and God-given ability will take them. We can never lose that. In times as challenging as these, I believe there's only one way forward. As a united America, united in our pursuit of a more perfect union, united in our dreams of a better future for us and for our children, united in our determination to make the coming years bright. Are you ready? I believe we are. This is a great nation. We're a good and decent people. For Lord's sake, this is the United States of America. And there's never been anything we've been able to accomplish when we've done it together. The Irish poet Seamus Heaney once wrote, "History says, don't hope on this side of the grave, but then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme." This is our moment to make hope and history rhyme with passion and purpose. Let us begin, you and I together, one nation, under God, united in our love for America, united in our love for each other. For love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. And light is more powerful than dark. This is our moment. This is our mission. May history be able to say that the end of this chapter of American darkness began here tonight, as love and hope and light join in the battle for the soul of the nation. And this is a battle we will win, and we'll do it together. I promise you. Thank you, and may God bless you, and may God protect our troops. Good night.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for August 28, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. A bit of kind of positive news to end up the week. 3.5 days before Hurricane Laura made landfall near Cameron, Louisiana, the National Hurricane Center predicted where it would come ashore within just over half a mile. Not only did it peg the location near the Texas-Louisiana border, but it forecast the exact hour it would cross the coastline, 2 a.m. Eastern. That comes from the Washington Post. The Post reports in the days between the forecast and when the storm roared inland, the Hurricane Center barely wavered from its prediction, even as hundreds of computer model simulations forecast landfall locations as far-flung as Florida and Mexico. Meantime, COVID-19 has created its own storm surge, a surge in the number of people seeking mental health treatment. That's according to the National Alliance of Mental Illness in Texas.
From March to April, NAMI Texas Executive Director Greg Hensch says they saw a 300% increase in calls from people due to anxiety, depression, difficulty sleeping, and other symptoms most said they'd never experienced before. He says most callers are age 55 or older. They're looking for resources or just someone to talk with about their anxieties.
It's definitely a lot of the isolation concern. Probably the second biggest would be uncertainty around their personal finances.
Experts recommend that people experiencing mental health issues try to follow a routine, get fresh air and exercise, eat well, and use clinical mental health services as needed. I'm Roz Brown.
Many Texans also face another source of anxiety. In the past 10 years, state residents have been hit with 15 federally declared major disasters for storms or wildfires, 6 of them in the Houston area. Demands for social justice in cities like Kenosha are linked to racial inequities deeply rooted in the nation's history. Researchers say these gaps are more prominent in Midwestern states
like Wisconsin.
Many recent protests are sparked by high-profile police shootings. But those cries also point to systemic racism, and recent studies find the Midwest has some of the worst outcomes for black residents. Laura Dresser of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy says when blacks fled to these states in the days of slavery, they may have found job stability in some cities, but housing policies paved the road for future problems.
Because of the residential segregation and because of the racism and discrimination in outlying areas, it made moving to where economic opportunity grew much more difficult.
Dresser contributed to a 2019 report led by the Economic Policy Institute that said all 12 Midwestern states have deep racial disparities in areas from education and jobs to health and home ownership. I'm Mike Moen.
This is PNS. Now a follow-up from another state, an issue we've been following. As the school year begins, parents who are students face enormous challenges brought on by the pandemic. Mary Ann DeMario runs a program at Monroe Community College in Rochester, New York, to support single students.
Pre-pandemic, our student parents were among the most at risk of our students. They had financial poverty. They had time poverty. Since the pandemic has begun, all of the difficulties that our student parents were experiencing before have only become magnified.
She notes that finding affordable child care is the most pressing issue among the 2,700 students at her school. Nationwide, nearly 4 million U.S. undergraduate students are parents or guardians of children under the age of 18. And the Connecticut Audubon Society, facing up to its mixed legacy on racism, with an open letter and an essay acknowledging that its namesake was a slave owner.
John James Audubon was a 19th century ornithologist and painter who extensively documented America's bird population. Patrick Cummins, who heads the Connecticut Audubon Society, released an open letter on Thursday calling Audubon a seminal figure in the birding world and an artistic genius who nonetheless had a terrible dark side.
He owned slaves, he traded slaves, and he sold slaves. And he even proudly told the story of having captured some former escaped slaves and returning them back to their former masters at gunpoint.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Finally, our Mary Sherman tells us there is some encouraging news about Illinois' potential for wind energy development.
The 17 states spanning the central U.S. are known as the Wind Belt, with roughly 80% of the nation's current and planned wind energy capacity. And Jeff Walk with the Nature Conservancy in Illinois says his group's new mapping tool called Site Wind Right uses wind, land use, and wildlife data to detect areas where conflicts between wind development and wildlife are likely to be minimal.
We've identified low-risk areas in that wind belt that could generate something on the order of about 100 gigawatts of energy, which is roughly equivalent to the total energy generation potential that the United States has today.
In Illinois, roughly 2 million acres are available for wind development. Walk says if that was built out, it could generate enough energy to power a city the size of Chicago. Walk sees wind energy development as an integral part of meeting the nation's climate goals. However, he notes when it isn't properly planned, wind development can negatively affect wildlife and ecosystems, in part because it requires large areas of land.
We need to be fully supportive of a rapid transition to renewable energy sources.
I'm Mary Sherman.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. We're member and listener supported. You can hear us on radio stations big and small, and of course online at publicnewsservice.org.
Health experts are warning the public to steer clear of a deadly plant extract. It's called oleandrin, and it's being touted by a financial backer of President Trump as a potential cure for COVID-19. It is not. There is zero proof that it works beyond a test tube, and it has never been tested on humans. A common landscaping plant in Mediterranean climates, including Southern California, oleander is among the most poisonous plants in the world, responsible for many poisonings each year worldwide. All parts of the oleander plant are highly toxic and may be fatal, Forbes magazine reports, citing research at the University of North Carolina. According to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, consuming a single leaf can kill you, causing heart arrhythmia, gastrointestinal problems, respiratory paralysis, coma, and death. Axios reports, quote, to the alarm of some government health officials, President Trump has expressed enthusiasm for the Food and Drug Administration to permit an extract from the oleander plant to be marketed as a dietary supplement or alternatively approved as a drug to cure COVID-19, despite any lack of proof that it works. The experimental botanical extract, oleandrin, was promoted to Trump during an Oval Office visit in July. So who's behind it? Well, according to Axios, quote, it is embraced by Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson and MyPillow founder and CEO Mike Lindell, a big Trump backer. Lindell recently took a financial stake in the company that develops the product, Phoenix Biotechnology. Trump has reportedly urged the FDA to approve oleandrin, even though there is no proof that it works or is safe in humans at any dosage. The only test results available were conducted in a laboratory test tube and were not reported in any journal peer-reviewed by scientists. Medical ethnobotanist Cassandra Corvey warns, quote, this does not take into account the well-known cardiac toxicity of the chemical when consumed by an animal or human. While many substances could potentially destroy a virus in a test tube, it doesn't make them safe for people to ingest. You wouldn't swallow gasoline or plutonium or a pesticide, for example, even if such a substance were shown capable of killing the virus. Dr. Quavre is particularly worrisome that consumers may misinterpret publicity about oleander and try to self-medicate with this highly poisonous plant, or that the dietary supplements industry may try to take advantage of the public's fear of COVID-19 by developing supplements containing oleandrin. She has this message for the public. Oleander is particularly dangerous because ingesting any part of the plant can lead to serious illness and possibly death. What's more, there is no published scientific evidence on the safety of consuming oleandrin or its plant source. She concludes, it is critical that the Food and Drug Administration and its commissioner, Dr. Stephen Hahn, make certain that the public is protected from this poison. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Sepulvedo.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.